Welcome to a very special PA podcast. On this PA interview spotlight, we have a special guest host, award-winning and hilarious comedian, Mr. Mark Bonto of Comedy on Tap. Mark and I enjoyed talking to one of America's comedy legends, Mr. Tom Dreesen. Please enjoy. Mm-hmm. Hey, Tom, I'm always curious how comedians chose to be a comedian. You know, how'd you get started?
Well, I sometimes think it chooses you. I don't know that you choose it, but I think it chooses you. But mine was purely by accident. I had no intention of ever being in show business, never thought about it, never fantasized about it. Came out of the service, and I wandered aimlessly. I didn't know what I, after 4 years in the service, I work construction, I wheel concrete, I work as a laborer. I mean, I tended bar,
Wow.
was a private detective, I was a photographer, I worked on the loading docks, I was loading trucks, and then I dropped my Teamster card and became the foreman for the, I went into management and became a foreman on the loading docks. I just wanted a name. I sold life insurance.
My goodness.
But I joined a group. I joined a group called the JCs, a civic group formerly called the Junior Chamber of Commerce. And they're you know, young men of action in the community, and had a lot of leadership training programs and stuff. And they did community projects, and I got involved with them and became very active. And then I wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. It's a concept I had, and there was, at that time, they weren't teaching drug education at a college level or high school level, let alone at an elementary school level. It was an idea. I thought we had to go there first. And I ran it as a JC project, but helping me on the project was a young man. He just graduated from Norfolk State College in Norfolk, Virginia, and EI DuPont recruited him into Chicago. And he joined the JCs that I was in, and the Harvey JCs, Harvey, Illinois JCs. And the night I was proposing that project, he said, I'd like to help you with that. And I said, gee, I already got a guy, but thank you very much. And the next day, the guy I had quit his job. And I mean, I took another new job, and he couldn't work with me. And I went and got this guy, and I said, gee, what was his name? A young black guy named, oh, yeah, Tim Reed. And so Tim and I, you know, we went to work on the project, and the program became very successful. And in 50 states and 22 foreign countries, the JCs used it as a model program through their publications. But one day, a little eighth grade girl said, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team. And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us because we used to play off of one another for a while and stuff. And so we became America's first black-and-white comedy team, and as history shows, we were the last. We stayed together 6 years, and the team broke up, and we wrote a book about that 2 years ago. Now it's becoming a movie.
Exactly. When's that supposed to come out, or the movie?
Well, we just saw the final draft a couple of days ago, and so who knows? From there, it goes on into...
What's the name of the book, Tom?
The book was called Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White. And we think the movie would be called Before Our Time. That's what I wanted the book to be called, because everywhere we went, people used to say, boy, you guys are before your time. And, of course, the movie will show that as well. So then the team broke up, and I went on my own and struggled like every other comedian. I ended up on the West Coast, hitchhiked up and down Sunset Boulevard, begging to work for free night after night at the Comedy Store. And then after about a year, the Tonight Show saw me, and I got my first Tonight Show, and as they say, the rest is history.
That's amazing. That's an amazing...
This is my 40... In September, I'll start my 44th year.
44th year. Wow. That's amazing. Now, your very first time when you did stand-up, what was that like? Like your very first time on the stage?
Well, with Tim, the very first time I ever worked as a comedy team with Tim, we were a nervous wreck. We didn't, you know, we had all of our material memorized, but we didn't have our timing memorized because we hadn't done it in front of a live audience yet. So we'd only rehearsed it at home, you know. So one night we finally got up, and in those days there were no comedy clubs.
Right.
There was one in New York called The Improvisation, but it didn't pay. It had a singer, then a comic, and so we had no place to be bad. So one night, Tim and I got up after a band got off, and the owner let us get up, and we went 100 miles an hour on stage. We were a comedy team with Tim and Tom. He's Tim, I'm Tom, and we just kept talking, and We rushed off the stage when we got done. We got the owner in a corner. How do we do? How do we do? What do you think? He said, whoa, 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 slow down. He said, I don't know. I don't know if you're funny or not. You never gave me a chance to laugh, you know. He said, come back tomorrow night and try the same thing again. And we came back the next night and slowed down and got our first laugh. And then to me, it was like an epiphany. Oh, my God.
It's like, that's it.
It's the greatest moment of my life. Oh, I knew. I knew that moment. I knew that moment that I got a laugh. It was something I had written. And it was like an OB movie where the dark clouds open up and the sun bursts through, you know. And I knew. I said, yeah, this is what I want to do the rest of my life.
Fantastic. Do you have any good heckler stories you'd like to share?
Well, every comedian, when you first start out, you know, you get hecklers and you're fearful of them because, you know, you're trying to take control of the stage. And when they start hollering from an audience and they take control and you haven't had any experience, it petrifies you, you know. But I learned through the years. I mean, Tim Reed and I worked. You got to remember, we worked what they call the Chitlin' Circuit, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs in the North and the South. There were no comedy clubs, I guess, in those days. And then also we worked all white clubs in the North and the South, too. And so, you know, as time went by, you learn how to deal with them. And I did. I became real good at it where, you know, I never let them take control. You know, but I've got a good heckler story. I get some bad heckler stories as well. A guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face the fourth time we ever went on stage and then tried to beat the hell out of me. I boxed when I was in the service, but this guy outweighed me by 100 pounds. Talk about a heckler, you know. I had another guy one time, attacked Tim and I in New Orleans.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
You know, but I've had hecklers. But I'll tell you a good heckler story. One night, trying out new material. Every time you do the Tonight Show, you got to do a new 5 minutes. And those, I did 61 appearances on the Tonight Show, so I was always working on new material. One night I was at the Improv around 1 o'clock in the morning with my tape recorder working on some new material. There was about 17 people in the audience. And I was just going all over the place trying out new material. But there was somebody in the back, way in the back, sitting by himself, a guy that I couldn't see because of the lights in my face. But I would do a line and get a laugh, and he would do a line on top of mine and get a bigger laugh.
Ooh.
And every time that I would do a line and get a laugh, he would do a line in the darkness and get a bigger laugh. And then finally, I did a line and got a big laugh. He did a line and got a bigger laugh, and I did a line on top of his and got the biggest laugh of the night. Now, I should have left the guy alone, but it got such a big laugh. I stepped outside the spotlight, and I walked stage left, and I said into the darkness where he was sitting, just between you and me, I won that one. And from the darkness, he said, just between you and me, you needed it.
That's a great story.
He was a funny guy. After the show, I went outside, and I met him, and I said, are you a comedy writer? Are you a comedian? He said, no. He said, I'm on vacation. I'm from Aurora, Colorado. And I said, oh, do you write comedies? No. I said, look, here's my card. If you ever want to write, you're really good. And he said, I hope you're not mad. I was just having fun. I said, no, I loved it. You know,
whatever happened to that guy? You never know what happened to that guy, right?
Never know. You know, his name was Chris Rock. He was, I'm being facetious here.
Never heard of him. Yeah, he disappeared into the darkness.
But there are people like that you meet in your life that are just witty and funny there was a guy named Joe Ansis way before my time that Rodney Dangerfield hung out with and Lenny Bruce hung out with. He, no matter what subject you were talking about, he wasn't a comedian, but he was funny, and he'd write down everything that he said, you know, because he was so clever and had such great observations. You know.
But he wouldn't get up on stage and do anything.
No. Those are special animals. You know, think about this, and this is, I give motivation speeches all over the country to corporate America and to universities, colleges, universities around the country. But I also give a motivation speech to comedians. It's called The Joy of Stand-Up Comedy and How to Get There. Mm-hmm. And I've done it in New York and Philadelphia and L.A. and Chicago, to comedians that have been in the business one day and been in the business 25 years. It doesn't matter. But it's a motivation speech. But one of the things I explained to them, how unique you are, that very few people can do what you do. Less than 1% of the population of the world make a living at what they love to do. You know, and if you love making people laugh, you're in that 1%. Now, here's the thing. They did a survey around the world many years ago of the 10 fears of man. Some insurance company did a survey for like 8 years all around. The 10 fears of man, death was fourth, pain was second, but getting up in front of an audience was the number one fear of mankind. Now, if you can get up in front of an audience and you're a house painter or you're a lawyer or you're a doctor or you're a bartender and you can talk about your profession for 1 hour, you're in less than 1% of the population of the world. But if you can get up and make people laugh for 1 hour, you're like 1/1,000,000 of 1% of the world. So how unique you are, and that's what I tell all young comedians, all old comedians, you know, this is the greatest profession on the planet. Don't tarnish it. You know, don't tarnish it by talking bad about other comedians. You never hear a doctor talk badly about another doctor. They don't do that because they have such respect for their profession. We, too, are physicians. We're physicians of the soul. We make people laugh. We change their body chemistry. You know, this is all scientific fact now, you know. So, you know, it's the greatest profession on the planet, and very few can do that. And if you can do it, you know, like I say, if you can make people laugh for an hour, you're in that less than 1/1,000,000 of 1% of the population of the world.
Have you ever had anybody come up to you and say, hey, you've just made me, I'm sure you have, but, you know, after a show or an appearance, just say, hey, you know, you've made me feel so good, I've turned around my outlook on life, I've wanted to do comedy. They attribute you to their better being or them to want to do comedy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, again, this is my going into my 44th year in showbiz. I've had a lot of those experiences that touch me. I had a woman one time. I was calling an attorney, and I had to leave a message on an answering service. And I said, would you have him call Tom Dreesen? And she went on to tell me that she said, I don't want to bother you, but my husband died a couple of years ago, but he had an incurable cancer. Like 3 months before he died, he said to her one night, let's just go out and go to the Comedy Store, and I just want to get some laughs. It had been such a tough time, but she said, you were on, and he laughed so heartily, and
wow.
And she said, to this day, I remember that night more than
her wow.
laugh.
And it's got to make you feel good.
Oh, of course. As well as, you know, comedians, young comedians have told me in the past that, gee, I saw you on TV. I always joke that they saw me on TV and they said, hell, if he can do that, I can do that, you know. but also I like to inspire them. I encourage them. I've never been in competition with another comedian. There's a great Hindu proverb that says there's nothing noble about being superior to another human being. True nobility lies in being superior to your former self. Am I a better friend than I was last year? Am I a better father than I was last year? Am I a better neighbor? Am I a better comedian than I was last year? So the only competition you have is with yourself for you to grow. No, another comedian, I started out with, look at my class. I mean, it was David Letterman, Jay Leno, Robin mm-hmm. Williams, Michael Keaton, Gallagher. We were all on the same stages together night after night, Elaine Boozler. These are wonderful friends of mine, and I'm their biggest fan. I cheer for them and root for them, you know, because I'm really proud of them. You know, I'm not in competition with them. Anybody that's been a comedian more than 10 minutes knows that comedy is subjective. There is no such thing as the funniest person on the planet.
Right.
It's all subjective. It's, you know, whoever may, your Aunt Edna might be the funniest person on the planet. She's the only one that makes you laugh, you know.
That's so true. So true. So you did a lot of Tonight shows with Johnny, right?
Yeah, well, I did 50 with Johnny
with
and 11
with Jay.
50
with Johnny. How was it?
11 with Jay.
How was it to meet Johnny? I mean, Johnny Carson. Wow.
You have to remember, let me put it in the proper perspective. In 1975, the comedy team broke up in 75. In 1975, when I came out here to the West Coast, the Tonight Show had been in New York, and then it moved out here to the West Coast. So all the comedians migrated out here, David Letterman, me, Jay Leno, you know, all those people I just mentioned, they all came out here to the West Coast because that's where Johnny Carson was. Because in 1975, when no matter where you were in America, no matter where you were, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth would be, oh, yeah? You ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. You might want to be one, but you weren't one now because that was the stamp of approval. Mm-hmm. So to do his show, the pressure was enormous. 15 million people watched the show in those days. You know, not only that, I mean, one appearance on The Tonight Show and Freddie Prinze got a sitcom. you know, one appearance on The Tonight Show, and the next day, CBS signed me to a development deal. A guy named Lee Curlin was watching the show in New York, and I was on the in the unemployment line one day with a wife and three kids, and the next day, I had a development deal by CBS, a check from CBS for $10,000 and $1,850 a month for 1 year in 1975. And Sammy Davis Jr. Took me on the road immediately. I was doing Dinah Shore, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, Midnight Special, rock concert, Soul Train, American Bandstand. I was doing all those shows. I was the only white comedian ever to do Soul Train. I mean, just because of that one appearance.
Isn't that amazing?
So when you met Johnny, I mean, he was like, and he was very humble and he was very nice, you know, in answer to your question. It was really a thrill to meet him. And I thanked him the rest of my career. I never stopped working since that first Tonight Show.
Now, you know, a lot of comedians, first time on the Tonight Show, they'll get that stamp of approval from Johnny. They get the thumbs up or the wink,
yeah.
or if you liked what you did, something like that. Did you get some kind of a look or a thumbs up from Johnny your first time?
He called me back through the curtain. You know, usually Johnny wouldn't let you sit down and talk to him until after you've been on two or three times, four times maybe. You know, on my third appearance, he let me sit down and talk to him. To America, when you had been on The Tonight Show, that was your stamp of approval. That to America, you were a comedian. But to our industry, when Johnny let you sit down and talk to them, that's when you had arrived. But my first appearance, I went out and I got 11 applause. And when I went back through the curtain, they kept applauding, and I was so excited, and the coordinator come running around the corner. He said, go back, they want you back, go back. And I was so nervous, I said, go back, you mean, go back and sit by, no, don't go back, just go back, go take a bow. And I went back through the curtain to take another bow, and the audience was applauding and cheering, and Johnny gave you that little circle.
Yeah, the little okay sign.
And I went back through that curtain, I mean, all hell broke loose. I cannot describe to you, you know, years of struggling, sleeping in the car, hitchhiking to the Comedy Store, not being able to pay the rent, buy groceries. I mean, all of that came to an end in that moment. You know, it was very dramatic. I closed my last line on that first Tonight Show was, I'd gotten so many applause, and I finally said, "Well, you've been a wonderful audience. And this is my first appearance on The Tonight Show. And, you know, show business is a tough life. So if you like me, just if you like me, and you're Protestant, say a prayer. If you're Catholic, light a candle. If you're Jewish, somebody in your family owns a nightclub. Come on, buddy, will you please?"
Excellent.
Yeah, it was a moment. In fact, in the movie that Tim and I, the movie about our life, that moment will be
great. I can't wait for that to come out. Now, you were also on, you mentioned David Letterman. Now, you've actually guest hosted his show. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've probably been on his show more than I was on The Tonight Show. Because, you know, I do it every 3 months. I'll do it like three times a year. You know, and I have for years and years. That's why I do his show exclusively now. Because if you do his show, then you don't do Jay's show. So there's that competition.
Yeah.
Even though Jay's a friend of mine, and I know Jay, but David and I were a lot closer. So, and as you pointed out, David let me host when he wasn't feeling good. So every time I see Dave, I say, "You look so hot. You need to take some time off." You know?
Perfect.
Oh.
Yeah, it's great. It's fun to do it with him because, you know, we started out together. I knew Dave when he didn't have any money at all. He had an old beat-up truck, an old red pickup truck that he drove from Indianapolis.
It's hard to believe in.
And we hung around together. We played basketball together. We played racquetball together. And we were on the same basketball team. So we've been friends a long time. So it's always fun to go do the show with him. You know?
Fantastic.
When you're on the road, is there any one place you like to perform most? Any one area, one place, any location that you really like doing?
Well, you know, now I like doing the theaters. I'm doing a one-man show called An Evening of Laughter and Stories of Sinatra. So it's an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hour show that I do in theaters. You know. And so that's really exciting for me. I think that's where stand-up comics need to go their next level, to get out of the comedy clubs in the Vegas stuff and go on to the theaters and do one-man shows, a retrospective of their life with comedy. I've always thought a good comedian can make you laugh for an hour and a half, but a great comedian can make you laugh and cry in an hour and a half. And that's what my one-man show does. I saw two comedians do that. One was Richard Pryor, and the other was Red Skelton. And I always thought, I want to do that one day. That was scary, to get an audience laughing, and then take them down a path where you have them in tears, and then to try to get them back again.
Oh, yeah.
So the theaters around the country are really exciting for me to work now, to go out on that big theater stage, 850 seats or 600 seats or whatever theater venue you're working. But for me as a nightclub comedian, I always liked Harrah's and Lake Tahoe. I like that. And also in Vegas, the old days, I mean, I worked Caesar's Palace, and I was under contract to 7 different hotels, and I still work in Las Vegas. But the best showrooms, to me, was the Desert Inn. It was a little more intimate. You know, when I was there with Sinatra, with Frank Sinatra, working the Desert Inn, when I was with Frank, we were under contract to the Riviera a couple years, to the Bally Grand a couple years, to the MGM Grand a couple years, to the Desert Inn, to the Sands, and to the Golden Nugget downtown. The Golden Nugget was a great little room to work. It was intimate. You know, stand-up comedians like that, low ceiling. Mm-hmm. You know, laughter is sound. It hits the ceiling and comes up at you. So the lower the ceiling, the fuller the sound. When you worked Caesar's Palace, that was a high ceiling. It was a great place to work, but it wasn't as intimate as the Desert Inn, so that was one of my favorites to work.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you first meet Frank?
I was, when I first met him, he would never remember, but I was working in Chicago. It was my first gig as a stand-up comedian. I was opening for Fats Domino at a place called Mr. Kelly's. And Frank was in town, and there was a comedian named Pat Henry that opened for him. And Pat took me to meet him. Pat and I got along real good. He liked me, and I wrote him some jokes, you know. And so he said, "You would like to meet Frank?" And he took me to the pump room at the Ambassador East Hotel in Chicago. And Frank was at the end of the bar with Jilly. And he walked on. He said, "Hey, Pat, where you been?" He said, "I'm hanging out." He said, "This is a kid I was telling you about, Tom Dreesen." And Frank said, "Hi, kid." That's all he said. And I went home and I put "Hi, kid" on my wall. You know, I thought that was great. But now years go by, and I toured with Sammy Davis, and I toured with Sammy for 3 years. And now I was working at in Lake Tahoe, at Caesar's in Lake Tahoe, and Frank was appearing at Harrah's next door. And after I came off stage one night, I rushed over there, and I went into I went into the showroom. I wanted to see Frank's show. I love the way he walked to a microphone. He created more excitement walking to a microphone than most people did with their whole act. You know, the audience would go wild when he walked out. So as I was running into the showroom, the vice president of Harrah's Hotel, a man named Holmes Hendrickson, very powerful guy in those days. I had worked at Harrah's for him. And he was out in front with a heavy-set guy with a cigar in his mouth. And as I was running into the showroom, he saw me, and he said, "Tommy, come here. Hurry up, come here." And I reluctantly went over there because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening. And I went over, and he said, "Tommy, this is Mickey Rudin." Well, I recognized the name, you know, R-U-D-I-N, Mickey Rudin. That was Frank Sinatra's lawyer. He said, "Mickey, this is Tom Dreesen. I think Tom would make a great opening act for Frank." And the lawyer got a pained expression on his face like he had heard that a million times. And he winked at the vice president, and I caught the wink. He said, "Hey, kid, if I give you a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? I said, "Mr. Rudin, put it this way. If you gave me a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? He said, "Oh, I like this kid." And he laughed, you know. And a week later, I got a call. Would I like to do 1 week with Frank Sinatra at the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City? And I thought, yeah, I'll work with him 1 week. I'll try to get my picture taken with him, and I'll hang it in every bar in Chicago, and that'll be it. But the second night I was with him, performing with him, he and his wife took me out to dinner. And in the middle of dinner, I can remember like it was yesterday, he put his knife and his fork down, and he said, "I like your material, and I like your style. I'd like you to do a few other dates with me if you're interested." And I didn't say, "Gee, let me check my calendar." I said, "Oh, yeah." I was thrilled, and it turned into 14 years, 45, 50 seasons a year. You know.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And a friendship, you know, that I'll always treasure. I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and I spoke at his funeral. And we became good friends.
You have any other great Sinatra stories you'd like to share?
I mean, that's what my one-man show about is about, all those stories, you know, an evening of laughter and stories of Sinatra. But there's many. I mean, there's so many I could tell.
Yeah, if you just go on one of your favorites.
There's a couple of on the funny, people say to me sometimes, is Frank, did he have a sense of humor? We were in a bar one night, and surprise that you did a bar with Frank Sinatra. But that's what he never went to bed till the sun came up. His whole life, he went to bed at dawn. You know, that's the only time he'd go to bed. Whether we were on the road or not, he went to bed at dawn. So anyhow, we were in a bar one night called Chaplin's Bar down in Palm Springs in Rancho Mirage. And the owner, Sidney Chaplin, gave him the keys to the place and tell him, you lock up, because he was going to stay till dawn. And Frank would always, sometimes we'd wait on ourselves, or sometimes there'd be a bartender. If there was a bartender, Frank, the bartender loved the steak, because Frank tipped $100 whenever you brought him a drink. If you brought him a drink or you brought him a pack of cigarettes, whatever you brought Frank, he'd give you $100. Comes a great story that one time he was coming out of Mame San restaurant, and the valet Parker brought his car up, and Frank was going to get in the car, and he said to the guy, what's the biggest tip you ever got? And the kid said $100, and Frank took two $100 bills out and gave him $200, and he said to the kid, by the way, who gave you the $100? He said, you did last Friday. but in the bar this night, you know, the night I'm telling you about, we were in there drinking, no one was in there. I was talking to him, and I saw over his shoulder, and a car pulled up out in front in a station wagon, and a woman behind the wheel stayed there, and another woman came out, and left the door, but she came running in. Frank had forgot to lock the door, so she came running in the place, and she stood behind Frank, and she said, excuse me, do they have a jukebox in here? And Frank Sinatra turned around and looked her right in the eye. He said, I'm sorry, what did you say? She said, did they have a jukebox in here? And Frank looked around all over, and he said, no, I don't think so. He said, I'll sing for you. She said, no, thanks. And she turned around and she walked out.
Wow.
And I watched him. He watched her go out the door like a little boy. He was watching her. And I said, she obviously didn't recognize you. He said, maybe she did.
Oh, no.
Being with him anywhere was always an experience, you know. He was a very interesting guy and a very generous. He gave more than anybody I've ever met in my life. The most charitable guy. One time we were coming out of a... you had to be very careful. If you were his friend, you had to be careful not to... if you couldn't say, gee, what a beautiful painting, he'd take it off the wall and give it to you. You couldn't say, oh, that's a nice watch. He'd take it off and he'd give it to you.
Wow.
His friends had to be very careful around him. One night coming out of the Waldorf Astoria, we were heading for a gig. And going into the limo, and a woman had been hiding in the doorway. The doorman told us for over 5 hours. He later told us. She saw him, and she came running, Mrs. Sinatra, and the security stopped her. And Frank, she's hollering, Mrs. Sinatra, please. And he stopped, and he turned around, and said, what is it? She said, my husband is home sick. If you would give me an autograph, it would mean the world to him. Please, Mrs. Sinatra. And so he signed the autograph. And while signing it, she said, oh, what beautiful cufflinks. They were $2,000 cufflinks. I know where he got them at. And he said, thank you. And after he finished the autograph, he took the cufflinks off and he handed them to her. He said, here, give these to your husband. She said, no. I was admiring them. And he said, no, that's all right. I want you to give them to your husband. When we got in the car, I said to him, Frank, that was beautiful. But why did you do that? He said, Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, then you don't possess it. It possesses you.
Wow. Wow.
And he didn't only talk that talk. He walked that talk.
You know? What a great guy.
Yeah, he was. He was a terrific guy.
Great story, and that's something to live by. Great, you know, great line too. You know.
Yeah. Well, he was full of those. You know, that was a wonderful thing about touring with him. As you know, if you're a comedian, you observe human behavior. Mm-hmm. It's just actors do it, comedians do it. We observe human behavior, so we recall it at later times. So he was a great study for me to watch. He was a very interesting human being. You know, controversial to say the least. And he could be moody, you know, but down deep inside was a decent human being, a real decent human being.
Well, do you got any anything you want coming up that you want to plug?
Well, I mean, the thing I plug is I'm touring the nation with an evening of laughter and memory and stories of Sinatra. It's called, you can go to my website, tomdreesen.com. It's Dreesen. Yeah, TomDreesen.com. And it tells you where I'm at. You know, I'm doing a lot of things around the country. You know, the show that I'm doing around the country, plus my own stand-up act that I do as well. And, I give motivation speeches around the country and a lot of other things that are just happening. I'm acting. I just did a film with Clint Eastwood where I did a few lines that I'll be taking the film clip on the Letterman show. I'm probably doing it in September coming up.
Great. That's amazing.
Very busy, but never mistake activity for achievement, but I'm very busy.
Well, Mark, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
I did, Nate. I just appreciate you allowing me to also be on the interview. Tab, you've been a huge impact in my life as well, so I wanted to thank you for that. I've been a stand-up comedian since 1978, and I was 16 years old back then. And before that, I, of course, watched comedians, and you know, before I got into comedy, I watched comedians and observed them, as you mentioned. And one of the ones I always loved and wanted to see, of course, was Tom Dreesen. So it's been great talking to you.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I appreciate that. I appreciate it. You should get, if you don't get the book Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White, you should also get a book called I'm Dying Up Here.
I'm Dying Up Here, okay.
It's by William Needleseeder, K-N-O-E-D-L-S-E-D-E-R. He used to work for the L.A. Times. In the year you were born, 1978, or you said you were born in 78?
No, I started stand-up comedy in 1978.
Okay,
I was 16 back then.
16.
But
I'm sorry, that year you started comedy was the year that we went on strike at the Comedy Store.
Okay,
And I'm Dying Up Here as a double entendre, because
mm-hmm.
a kid committed suicide, a comedian, and also that's what we say when we don't do well. I died last night. But that book is fascinating, and it's all about that era, that time, when you first started out in 1978. I think you'll really enjoy the book.
Well, that sounds great. I'll definitely look into it. That's something great. And who wrote that again?
His name is William K-N-O-E-D-E-L-S-E-D-E-R. You can look it up at Amazon.
Okay.
I'm Dying Up Here. In fact, Jim Carrey just optioned that book to possibly do a movie from it. But it's all about that era and that time and what it was like in 78 to try to make it in America,
mm-hmm.
and how the Comedy Store was making millions of dollars but wasn't paying the comedians. They paid the waiters and the waitresses and the bartenders and the guy who cleaned the toilets, but comedians got nothing. And what the comedians did in that era, I think you'll really find it interesting. And it should be, every comedian in America should read it, because it's a history of a change. It totally changed the course of comedy after what those kids did.
Yeah.
I'll definitely have to look that up. That sounds, and it was a great time. It was an era that I'd definitely be interested in reading. So.
Yeah, you'll find the book fascinating, I think. You can let me know. Write to me on my website or at dreesenproductions@yahoo.com.
Well, definitely will do. That's great.
Okay. Okay, fellas, it was great talking to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it again, Tom, and for you to take your time with us. And this has been fantastic, a dream come true.
I was glad to do it, really glad to do it.
Thanks for being so gracious to do this too, Tom. We appreciate it.
Okay, right. Take care, guys.
Take care now.
Alrighty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I think Mark Bonto and myself agree that was an amazing interview with a comedy legend. We so wish to thank Tom Dreesen for his graciousness and those interesting stories of his life. Contact Tom at tomdreesen.com. A big thank you to Mr. Mark Bonto for guest hosting. Contact Mark on Facebook at facebook.com/funnyman1. Funny Man and the number one. Or email at funnymanmb@yahoo.com. And thanks to our producer Jenny Coe, aka Bony Fingers McGee. You can find us at thepapodcast.com, on iTunes and Stitcher. Be kind, laugh, and enjoy life. Thanks for listening.